Okay, I guess we better get started.
Can you hear me there okay?
Yep.
I can hear you now. Now that you got your headset on.
I got to get my Captain Video headset off.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll call this meeting to order. This is our virtual commission meeting for October the 12th. And welcome everyone. We'll start by approval of the consent agenda. There is a couple of changes there. Or at least one change. The dollar amount that went out initially has changed. It is now, this is for the claim vouchers for September the 14th through October the 5th. That new dollar amount is a total of $4,146,838.44. And one other comment on the business items. The electric, water, and wastewater budget will only be reviewed. There will not be an approval. So with that, do I have a motion on the consent agenda?
I have a question.
Okay, Jim.
Sean, I guess this is for you. Looking at the, and this is more of a process question, I'm sure, but under the monthly debt write-offs, you know, we have half dozen or dozen of these. How do we distinguish? I mean, when we have a debt write-off, that means we've already cut their power off, I assume. And so how does that square with the COVID rules for not terminating people's power, or how is this different? Is it?
The difference right now is that we're not sending anybody to collections as an active customer. So these write-offs are for customers that are no longer with the district, have notified us that they're no longer a customer, and are not paying their bill. And so we're sending those delinquents to collections at this time.
So when they say they're no longer a customer, does that mean, like I noticed somebody said they were homeless and couldn't pay their bill, but that means you're saying they're no longer a customer. They told us clearly that they've moved out of the house, they're no longer there, or they're not moving back in, and yada, yada, yada. Is that how we make that determination?
Right. Somebody else has signed for the service that they used to be at. So they're no longer a customer of ours.
Okay. All right.
That's why the write-offs are relatively low right now, is because we are not sending per proclamation the other customers to collections.
Right. Okay. That's the only question I had.
Somebody needs to mute out there. The dollar amount's pretty large compared to what we've seen in the past. So, is there an explanation for that?
To be honest, Will, I didn't look at the write-offs this morning but I can look at it real quick.
No problem. I thought that might be what prompted Jim's question. Okay, any other comments or questions on the consent agenda? Well, do I have a motion?
Yeah, I'll move that we approve the consent agenda for the listed items.
And I'll second that.
Okay, it has been moved and seconded that the consent agenda for October the 12th be approved with the items listed on the agenda. All those in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Great. Okay, our next item is agenda revisions. Do we have any, Doug?
No revisions, Will.
Okay, anything from the commission?
No, I'm fine.
No, I don't have anything.
Okay, great. Comments from the public. Sean, you're going to police this, right?
Sure. If anybody would like to make a comment at this time, give me your first name and I'll call in the order that I receive them.
Carolyn Wilcox.
Go ahead, Carolyn.
Okay. Let me just, there's like lots of hand raising and things up here. Okay, so my name is Carolyn Wilcox, and I live in the city of Port Angeles. And can everyone hear me okay?
Yes.
Great. And I am a elected member of the board for the Clallam Conservation District, but in this role, I'm just speaking as a resident of Port Angeles and not in that role. And I am sure that you are all well aware of the damage the Snake River dams have caused salmon and orca in the Pacific Northwest. Since their inception, salmon have declined steadily towards extinction despite billions spent on recovery efforts. Even with a new environmental impact statement, the bias of the industry is paramount, ignoring available science and concluding that the same recovery efforts that have not worked in 20 years will be the plan going forward. The federal agencies have been sued 5 times over inadequate recovery methods, and they are content to continue being sued. What I'm here to say is that I no longer want to support the Snake River dams when I pay my power bill. If I am not utilizing the power coming from the dams because it contributes to the surplus sold out of the Pacific Northwest and they are contributing to the collapse of our fisheries and resident orcas, then I should not be forced to pay for them. No one should be forced to pay for them given opposition to the management of this asset is clear and justified. Us tier one ratepayers are the losers of this expensive deal, and I urge you to draft a resolution that states our customer choice preference for power exclude the Snake River dams. I want no more of my money funding these dams. Thank you.
Carolyn, you say you're a resident of Port Angeles. Are you a PUD customer?
I don't think that I am.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks.
We have others, Sean?
I heard no others, Will.
Okay. We'll move on to business items. The first is appointment of a hearing officer. Doug, you're going to handle that one, I believe.
Yeah, I handle that. Hold on a second, Will. Yes, in the past and continuing, we have a hearing officer appointed, and the commission appoints that. In our electric service regulations, it says basically a hearing officer and any deputy or assistant hearing officer shall be management level employees and shall be appointed by the commission from employees whose other duties are not connected with the credit section. So in the past we had Simon, before that we had Dave Papandrew. And so what I'd like to do is nominate, and what this officer does is any claims that might be out there, if there's an appeal, this after it goes through the normal process, they have an appeal, then this hearing officer would hear the appeal and make a decision. So what we'd like to do is ask you to nominate or to approve the nomination of Lori Carter, who's our controller auditing officer, and also as an assistant to her, or I guess you'd call it an assistant hearing officer, appoint Nicole Clark, who's our communication and government relations manager. So with that, I'll ask for at least a head nod, or I will put in the minutes if all three of the commissioners are okay with that, with those officers.
I believe with the exception of Simon, that traditionally the auditor has been the hearings officer. Is that correct?
You mean the auditor, I believe.
Actually, the auditor is what I said, I thought, but okay, yeah.
Yeah. I think that's pretty much been it in the past, now I think about it, sure.
Okay, thank you.
So you're adding these two. Are there any others that are currently serving in that function, or is there nobody right now?
There's nobody left there, Dave, so they're all gone now.
Okay.
Yeah, I have no more questions. I think it's a good idea.
Okay, thank you.
Doug, the hearing officer basically is looking at financial accountability, accounting issues and stuff like that, which fits Lori. Explain it, what Nicole Clark is a communications person. How does her job kind of fit into a hearing officer?
Yeah, a hearing officer doesn't necessarily based on accounting and numbers and all. It could be based on, say, somebody claims that we had marked their went out, the lineman went out and marked where we said our electric lines were, and someone dug into it and claims that they wasn't where we said they were. So a lot of it's just hearing all the different parts of it and then coming up with a decision whether the PUD's argument or the customer's argument or vendor's argument or contractor's argument is right. So it, in the past, we've had the communication manager has been an assistant in the past also. So it's not strictly numbers, I guess.
Does the hearing officer, what kind of authority when they make a recommendation? Is it a recommendation to us? Is it a decision? I'm trying to understand what is their level of enforcement on their,
okay.
They listen to something, they make a decision or make a recommendation to you or us or what?
Right.
It may help to talk about the appeal process.
Yeah, they make the final decision. However, there's always an appeal process to the commission. So if the whoever's appealing doesn't agree with the decision, they can bring it to the commission. The commission can overrule or consent with the ruling. So the commission would be the last and final decision if someone wanted to continue to appeal it. And that's pretty much why it talks about upper management. So it's somebody that has a pretty good idea of what's going on in an overview of the whole company, not just a particular specific area. Using Nicole again, not to use her as an example, but Nicole is pretty much in tune with everything that's going on in the PUD and can be up and mainly a lot of it's common sense, a lot of it's good judgment, and both Lori and Nicole, we believe, have that good judgment.
Is there a scenario where you would have an independent hearing officer, like somebody that's not actually a staff member of the PUD, but somebody from the public?
As far as our electric service regulations, no, it's an employee. And just to let you know, Sean, Sean Worthington, we talked, but Sean's over the numbers and the credit side of it, which in the regulations says you can't be someone from the credit. And someone like John, probably a good percentage of the cases come in John's area, so it wouldn't be fair for John to make a decision saying that, if it's one of his people that were involved in the decision. So we're trying to find someone that's more neutral over the situation. So someone
Doug,
like
can
Lori,
I speak to this for a second?
Nicole. Yeah, go ahead, Nicole.
I've done this a couple of times in the past under Mike Howe and Dave Papandrew, and what usually happens as far as the appeal process goes is say there's a claim for damages that's filed. The first thing that happens is it comes in and it's usually assigned to Larry, and as the safety officer, he'll go out and he'll do the actual investigation and provide his recommendation, and the letter goes to the customer. At that point, then the customer either accepts it or if they decide they want to appeal it, that's when it comes back, and they'll set up a date with the hearing officer to come and present any information that they haven't already submitted with the damage claim. So you're really just kind of a neutral party who's not part of the investigation side of it, hearing any additional information that the customer wants to bring. And at that point, then you go back and you can take it back to the investigation team. You can review it and meet with staff and find out if, you know, we have new information perhaps, and make then the determination. And then at that point, as Doug said, if the customers wants to take it further, they can go to the commission. But really, it's kind of a point, midway point between when the investigation first happens under the safety officer and the letter and determination is made. It's that midway point where they want to appeal or provide extra information.
Yeah, thank you for that, Nicole, because what, as she said, Larry does the investigation, puts together a report. Reports goes to, if it's in John's area, John signs off on. If it's in Tom Martin, the water area, Tom signs off on it. And then it comes to me, and then I sign off on it. And I would say 99% of these are fine, and they're closed out. It's just the rare ones that do appeal, and then, as I mentioned, the process goes to the hearing officer and or the assistant.
Okay,
so there is a pretty good process in line for reviewing it and agreeing. And there's been a number of times that I've disagreed with the decision and it's gone back. And I'm sure the same is true with Tom and John too. So that's why it's only like a very small percentage that goes any further.
And I think that's true with people that come to the commission as well. So do we have a thumbs up on that?
Yeah, I think it's a good idea.
Okay. Yeah, I agree. I think it's pretty consistent with what we've done. It's worked pretty well.
Okay, with
yeah.
Jim. See Jim's head nodding, so close enough. Okay, thank you.
He said okay. All right, thank you. If you have any suggestions, just let me know. Okay,
okay.
That's all, Will. Thanks.
All right, thank you. Our next item is acceptance memo for completion of bid number 201004. John, I think you've got that one.
Yes, sir. Staff requests the commission authorize acceptance memo of completion for bid number 201004 to Pacific Pole Inspection, LLC. This pole inspection, treating, and reporting project for the electric transmission distribution poles within Clallam and Jefferson counties was complete on August 19th, 2020. The total contract cost is $136,133.11, including Washington State sales tax. We had a very successful inspection program going on now 30-plus years. And this particular round of inspection looked at almost 10% of our poles. We try to do this on a 10-year cycle, so we get someone outside the PUD looking at the poles. And the reject rate was probably the best we've ever had. I believe we only had 9 of close to 2,000 poles that were identified needing replacement. Which tells me that our in-house line crews and their inspection program is going very well. So we request the commission authorize the memo as provided.
So this company is doing a good job, and they are the low bidder repeatedly, I believe.
Correct. They've been low bid 3 consecutive years.
Okay, good.
John, we voted on this once or twice before. Is this a separate contract from the ones we approved about a month or two ago, or is this the same contract?
It's a multiple-step process. There's an award of the bid, and then there's an approval of the completion of the project.
Yeah, and I thought we did that last meeting.
No, I do not believe we did.
Okay. Must be deja vu.
Yeah.
there's others out there. Different contracts.
Do we have a motion on this one?
Well, I have a question. Refresh my memory, but when we award these contracts, do we specify a certain minimum number of poles that they'll inspect within a specific time frame, or how does the original contract set this out?
The original contract is set on a unit cost, number of poles inspected, number of poles treated, number of poles where they might add a down guy, guard, or label. So we have, I believe, in the original contract, 11 items, and each one is quoted as a unit cost.
Right, okay. As far as the completion of the contract, in past years, don't they usually run into September when they do this? Or?
It varies. Sometimes they go a little bit longer, sometimes shorter. It depends on how early in the spring we get them out. Usually we get the contract out sooner than we did this year because of COVID.
Oh, okay. So they did a pretty small window of time. They got a lot of work done.
Yeah, surprisingly. We thought that their completion would be 6 weeks later than they did, but they got it done promptly.
Okay. Well, if nobody else has any questions, I move that we approve the acceptance of bid number 201004 for the pole inspection done by Pacific Pole Inspection LLC, completed August 19th, and the total contract cost is $136,133.11, including Washington State sales tax.
I'll second that.
Been moved and seconded to authorize acceptance memo for completion of bid number 201004 to Pacific Pole Inspection, LLC. Pole inspection, treating, reporting project for electrical transmission distribution poles within Clallam and Jefferson counties was completed August the 19th, 2020. The total contract amount cost is $136,133.11, including Washington State sales tax. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All right. Our next item is Resolution 2181-20, the 2020 staff titles, salary ranges, and position addition. Sean?
Yeah, good afternoon. Staff is proposing a single change to the titles and monthly salary ranges for staff employees, and that is adding the job of compliance analyst at the grade 20 in the staff salary ranges. The position is being added to serve a part-time 15 to 20-hour need in the areas of accounting, finance, and risk management. With the departure of Simon, we do have an existing gap in our risk management and PERMS administration, as well as an immediate need in the accounting department. And the primary duties of the position are outlined in the job description that was attached to the board packet. Staff is requesting that the board approve Resolution 2181-20 as submitted, adopting the revised 2020 staff titles and salary ranges, and rescinding Resolution number 2168-20. And if there's any questions, Lori and I can both probably answer them at this time.
Yeah, I have a question that says it's part-time. Now, is the rate of pay, is that full-time equivalent rate of pay, or is that what's considered a half-time, or what percentage of full-time is that rate of pay?
Yeah, that's an equivalent rate of pay, so the salary would be based on an hourly rate off of that scale.
Okay.
So how many hours do you think this person will work?
We believe that it will probably start out in 15 hours per week and gradually work 15 to 20 hours per week would be probably the average.
You know, looking at the job description, it's pretty broad. There's a lot of job functions there, so we'll see how that goes.
Yeah, and Sean, are we going to hire somebody part-time, or are we going to shift some duties here internally to cover this on a part-time basis?
No, this would be hiring somebody externally. More than likely to come in and fill this need.
Okay. And my second question is, you said that you're modifying the one that was effective in January of this year, but that has compliance analysts on it, doesn't it? And so I'm trying to figure out what is actually changing here on the
Yeah, so the first one in the board packet shows the change in red of compliance analysts in grade 20, and then the second one shows a updated version, assuming the resolution is adopted. But the one from 20 doesn't include the compliance analyst.
Okay, I see the problem. There's no red in this.
Oh.
In the one you sent.
I'm not exactly sure how that got sent out. The one that I provided, I know it had red.
All right, well, that explains why I see it here, but it's...
Yeah, no, that makes sense.
Okay.
Okay, do we have a motion?
Yeah, I move that we approve resolution 2181-20, 2020 staff title, salary ranges, and position edition. For the position of compliance officer.
I'll second that.
That job title is different. We're calling this a analyst, I believe, on the one description. Is this...
compliance analyst should be the accurate job title.
Okay, so we'll change officer to analyst.
Yeah. Okay,
it's been moved and seconded for approval of resolution number 2181-20, the 2020 staff titles, salary ranges, and position addition to add the position of compliance analyst to the staff titles. All those in favor?
Aye.
Good. Thank you. All right. Our next item is the 2021 electric, water, and wastewater budget proposal. This is the first blush at first pass of looking at this. So.
Yeah. Well, let me jump in here before Sean for a second. Okay. As you mentioned, this is just a review. It's not any final approval. What we've done this year is a little different than what we've done in previous years, both for this and the strategic plan. I'll be talking about the strategic plan in a few minutes on in the staff report. But what we're looking at is bringing it up front, and it'll be on the website so the public and the commissioners can review it. So we've got the rest of October, November, and then we usually will be going for approval in the first, maybe second meeting of December. And so this is just allows the public to look at it and commissioners, and any comments that you have, Nicole will have this on the website, and anyone that wants to respond to it or question it or have any things they want to contribute, please do so. So that's the plan that's set up for this year, and I think that should work out well. So both for the budget and for the strategic plan, both of them. Okay, Sean, it's all yours.
All right, thanks, Doug. I'm going to share my screen here, make sure we can all see it. Can everybody see the big slide?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. All right, so thanks, Doug, for that introduction. We're going to be going through the 2021 budget proposal this afternoon for electric, water, and wastewater. We do have a little over 40 slides to get through, so if at any point anybody needs to take a break, just let me know. And then also, as we're going through this, if any of the commissioners have any questions that come up as we go through, please don't hesitate to stop and ask. We'll be more than happy to address and answer anything that we can. So this afternoon, Ruth and myself are going to be presenting the budget. Ruth is going to cover the capital and debt pieces for each of the three systems, and I'll primarily touch on the rest of the items. All right, so jumping in here, as a refresher, I just included this slide to illustrate the process it takes each year to put the budget together. And a lot of people don't know this, but it takes the better part of 6 to 7 months and touches every single department here at the district. So in June of each year, or July, but typically June, finance will reach out to all the different departments at the district and provide each manager and supervisor with a template to complete their O&M and their capital budgets. And so while they're compiling that, finance is then working on the personnel side of it, salaries, wages, taxes, benefits, and putting it all together. And so in August and September, as the managers complete their budgets and send them on to finance, we compile a master budget. Typically at this point, it's around 1,000 separate line items of different expenditures. And when we compile it, we also determine what our revenue requirement is going to be, and we also evaluate what the rate impacts are going to be for that budget. And that leads us up to where we are today, October. We have a commissioner work session where we go over the initial findings. And then, as Doug mentioned, towards the end of the year, typically the last board meeting of the year, we ask for approval and typically take any rate impacts at that time as well. So as we're compiling the budget, we try to meet certain objectives. And we use our strategic plan as sort of our guiding principle in how we go about this. The first objective is we want to make sure that we're providing stable rates, which is basically small annual inflationary type rate increases each year. We want to be financially responsible, only incur expenses that are necessary to maintain the reliability, safety, and operation of the district. And speaking of reliability, we want to make sure that the projects that we're doing have a favorable return on investment and that our managers, primarily Doug and John, John and Tom, who prepare the 10-year capital plan for electric and water, that they're strategically assessing the needs of those systems. And then finally, on the objectives, we want to make sure that we maintain healthy fiscal targets. We're always shooting to achieve 150 to 180 days cash on hand for electric, that our debt ratio is less than 30%, and that we're meeting our bond covenants of at least 1.25 times, but preferably 2 times. And so as we're trying to meet those objectives in compiling the budget, we're definitely faced with some challenges. Number one, the district has declining kilowatt hour sales. Since 2014, we're down about 3%. And when you factor in the fact that we have about a 6% increase in our customer base, it's actually about a 9% decrease per customer since 2014. So that's pretty substantial. The weather, as we all know, is changing and less predictable, making it more difficult to forecast. And then we also have increasing costs, such as power supply. Our BPA rate increase this month that goes into effect will be 2.07%. And then we also have unbudgeted things like the pandemic where we're going to have increased write-offs. And then personnel costs are also going up. The state initiated a Family Medical Leave Act this year, and the original projection was that it was going to cost about $60,000 to the district. But because of the pandemic, the coffers have run dry at the state, and we're anticipating possibly triple, maybe quadruple rates going into next year. PERS and healthcare costs are also increasing. We may reach $4 million in healthcare expenses this year. And then a big challenge is capital. We're an electric and water utility, and everything that we do is pretty expensive on the capital front. And then finally, regulatory costs, things that are coming down from the legislature that are very expensive, the Clean Energy Transformation Act and WSDOT projects that are related to fish passage, where they're removing culverts and installing bridges to allow better opportunity for fish migration. These things all add extra costs to the district that sometimes are unplanned.
Could I make one comment?
Sure.
You mentioned ROI. I think hopefully most people understand this, but that's a cost-benefit analysis. It's not profit, and it's to compare alternate expenditure funds on different projects. So just totally.
Thanks, Will. I forgot to clarify that.
That's a good point. It's so we can look at number of projects, and then do the one that actually shows the most benefit to the utility and to the customers.
Sean, a couple questions on the slide four. When you were describing provide stable rates, I think you said what we do is we just try to restrict it to cost inflationary pressures and stuff like that. And I guess a nuance here is, you know, utilities are inflation are us. And so I guess one of our, part of our budget objectives should, like we have in our, you know, we've talked about in our strategic plan, is to see if, to also see if we can reduce our budget, reduce our rates or something like that, so that we don't just continually accept that whatever happens, it's always going to go up. And because that becomes a cultural norm then, and so I don't, you know, maybe you guys think that that's not really a budget objective but a strategic objective, but to me, if the strategy doesn't fall off into your budget objectives, we may have a bit of a disconnect. That's a comment, and also and you can, if you have something to say, but let me add the other point I want to make. The debt ratio you've got down there of less than 30%, is that the debt-to-asset ratio you're talking about there?
Right, right.
And
am I muted? I can't tell. No.
I didn't see that anywhere in here. Are you going to cover what it is right now?
Ruth, I think she has that information.
It's in the presentation later.
All right, we'll wait then.
Okay.
Yeah, regarding the stable rates, Jim, I know you've mentioned this before. This originally started when we started putting together the strategic plan, because with Bonneville, they were having like 8% plus increases, and they'd go, I mean, they were just all over the board. So what we made the decision up front, instead of jumping customers up to 8% 1 year and down to 2% another year and up and down, that we would kind of flatten it out. So not only for our budget, but for customers that wanting to budget, that they can have a more understanding and a stable understanding of what's coming possibly in the future. Now, as we've mentioned before too, we do look, and we've given, I think, presentations before on showing the many ways which we have reduced rates. Matter of fact, Sean will be showing some of them at the end of this or somewhat later in the show, areas that we have reduced over time. So we do sharpen our pencil. We look at it constantly. And, you know, again, with the ROI comment, we look at the highest value to the PUD. So it's something that's on every manager's mind, and we try to instill it on all of our employees. So anyway, and at some point in the future, hopefully we can lower rates. But at this point in time, with Bonneville still increasing significantly, we do have some rates increases.
Yeah, Doug, can I add something? Jim has a very good point. Over the last 10 years, we've actually faced increasing cost in many ways beyond inflation, most recently the seed and fish passage issue where we have to relocate utilities is a lot higher than projected. And one way we try to control costs, we haven't actually been able to reduce rates in any given year, is through productivity enhancements, which allows us to do more with fewer people. And Sean's going to touch on that a little bit later in the presentation. One example, the battery project we talked about last time, if we do proceed as we expect we will be able to proceed, it will have a return benefit of a rate decrease, or at least a lowering of the increase, 0.9%. So one of the main emphases that we've had for information systems and doing things better than we did in the past, we're really focusing on that, and it's incorporated into the strategic plan. And we try to do that primarily through productivity enhancements, doing things better, faster, cheaper. And that's an ongoing effort that we're really targeted on and have been for some time.
But, you know, the other side of that ledger, Costs go up, material costs go up, labor costs go up, and it's not all about Bonneville. So, you know, we can either absorb those costs or we can try to be more efficient and look for different alternates, which I think we're doing. But if you try to ignore it, your increased cost, you're kind of on the going out of business curve.
Yeah, I mean, in the past presentation that we gave, the options that we showed with CETA coming up and that battery is distribution battery, as John mentioned, you know, that's a considerable cost to us and the customers. So we continually watch it. We continually stay on top of it. And I think it shows. So anyway, as Sean was mentioning, with our revenue actually declining kilowatt sales, we are staying on top of it.
And all these mandates cost money. You know, the legislature passes a mandate which increases our cost, and they're kind of insulated from the public impact of that. So, you know, we need to tell people to go talk to their legislators in a lot of cases.
Yeah, I guess I would just think that, you know, so why not say some of that kind of stuff in a budget objective? You know, that we are pursuing wherever we can reduce costs that hopefully could impact rents.
To answer your earlier question, Jim, our current debt ratio is 24%.
Thank you.
Yep. Any other comments on this slide?
Okay. I don't have any.
Go ahead, Sean.
Okay, before I jump into some of the numbers here, we do make some assumptions when we're compiling our budget. And so for the current year assumptions, our revenues are based on our year-to-date plus our BPA load forecast through the end of the year. We've also had substantially reduced interest income this year due to COVID. In April, the LGIP basically tanked and is pretty much at 0% right now. And we've lost about $250,000 this year in revenue from late fee income, also due to COVID and the governor's proclamation. On the expense side, we're assuming that through the end of the year, we'll have our existing personnel count. We're basing it on our average O&M cost through the end of the year. And our COVID-related write-offs, which are uncertain at this point, but we have accounted for increases in write-offs. And our BPA power procurement is down about 3.6% this year, and we'll also have some continuing I-937 regulatory issues through the end of this year. As far as capital, we started off the year very slow with COVID. We had a lot of projects that we put on hold and delayed. As of this summer and the latter half of the year, we've really picked those back up and are having a full court press. So we are going to have some pretty big capital expenses, including the Forks Operations Center that's currently underway. And then as we discussed in our last presentation to the board last month, we do plan to create the decarbonization fund for CETA in December of this year. Moving to 21, the assumptions that we made on the budget for next year, our BPA rate increase is based off of the 2021 rate impact model. We're estimating 0.75% customer/meter growth and a decline in kilowatt hour sales of -0.2%. Our conservation expenses are based off our 2019 conservation potential assessment, which gets updated every 2 years. And so we will have an update that will begin first quarter of next year, working with EES Consulting. Our PERS contributions is going up slightly. We've already bargained our CBA for next year, and those increases will go into effect May 1st of 21. And then we're operating under the assumptions that there's no change to the approved rate increases for electric and water, which go into effect April 1 for electric and then February 1st for water and wastewater. Finally, on our assumptions, I had to make some regarding CETA. We are assuming that we are going to move forward with the seeded decarbonization fund that probably will be used for a utility scale distribution battery. When we did make the presentation last month, we had discussed potentially starting the fund with up to $6 to $7 million, but based on some intense capital projects through the end of this year and next, we needed to lower that to $5.2 million as a starting balance. We do still plan to rate fund the next 10 years, $575,000 per year into the fund. Because of the lower starting balance, we will probably have to delay a project from 2024 to a few years later. However, if we still wanted to do a project in the 24 or 25 timeframe, we could probably do that with some small bank loan borrowing.
So, Sean, you're going to, this $575,000 per year over a 10-year period, you're going to, that's how you're going to fund this CETA fund, right? There's no large transfer of capital or revenue to this fund in the initially, right?
Initially, we will start this year in 2020 with $5.2 million. We'll take that out of our operating fund. And then the subsequent years, we'll rate fund $575,000 to build it up to about $10 million to complete the battery project, if that's what we decide to move forward with.
By operating fund, you mean reserves?
Yes.
Okay.
The second part of this slide is the other piece of CETA, which is the low-income portion. And basically, it's the legislation mandates that all utilities in the state have a low-income program in place by July 31st of next year. And our current program that we have is not compliant with the existing legislation. So more than likely, we're going to need to eliminate our current program and establish a new program with OLECAP, where OLECAP will administer direct bill assistance and weatherization to our customers. One thing that we need to discuss is how we're going to fund the OLECAP overhead piece. The law isn't completely written on this yet. They're still going through the rulemaking, but this is something that we're going to have to get into the first quarter or the latter half of this year and develop a program. But as we've discussed in the past in our presentations, it might be a line item on the bill for all customers that are not low income. And just for reference purposes, the legislation references using 2018 as our baseline year for assistance and increasing that by 15%. So for us, the financial expense in 2021 could be as high as $325,000 or more, depending on this overhead piece that I discussed. So we'll get into this more at the end of this year, towards the beginning of next year, and hopefully come back to the commission with a new program that'll be compliant with legislation.
There was some criticism of OLECAP of the their cost to administer these programs. Is that still a concern, or is there an alternative to OLECAP?
It is a concern. What makes them ideal is the fact that they have access to the state systems where they can accurately underwrite customers. We just don't have access to, you know, the IRS and the Department of Health and Human Services database. And so if OLECAP can underwrite it for us, they'll have better data than we do. The concern that OLECAP has is the influx of customers that we would potentially be sending their way, and they want to make sure that they could staff appropriately for this influx. The good news is that they currently underwrite the LIHEAP portion, and the majority of the customers that qualify for LIHEAP would also qualify for our new program. So there could be a situation where a customer wouldn't have to reapply once they apply for LIHEAP. So it makes sense to partner with OLECAP, and I believe that they're open to it from the meeting that we had, and it's just going to require some follow-up meetings, Will, to ensure success.
Thank you.
Okay, so after outlining those assumptions, I can actually jump into some of the numbers for next year here. So we'll go through the electric system first. And the first piece here is our revenue and expenses. So here's the first slide with our revenue for the electric system. The biggest change that you'll notice on this slide is that in 2020, we're projecting to use $7.5 million of our 2018 bond proceeds. And that's primarily for the Forks Operations Center and other capital projects that meet the requirements. And then we'll use the remaining bond proceeds in 21 to finalize the substation rebuild out in Forks, and then also the final push to complete the Forks Operations Center. So that was why it looks like our revenue is substantially lower next year. The other piece that I guess I'll note real quick here is on the other, our 2020 projection of 2.5 includes the sale of the Port Angeles administration building. And we obviously won't have that sale happen next year also. So that's why you see the dip there in other income. Moving on to expenses, the big change here from 2020 to 21 is in the capital. And this is primarily driven from the Forks Operations Center. The big bulk of the work will be done in 2020, and just a little bit residual will be left over next year. And so in 21, we're forecasting $70.7 million in expenses. And if you look on the pie chart down below, you can see that capital, purchase power, and salaries equate about 70% of our total budget. And O&M is a small 8.8% of our budget. And that's primarily where we can make some of those cuts that Jim was talking about. And Ruth and I, when we go through the budgets, we meet with all the department heads and we go through the line items with the managers, making sure that, you know, the expenditures that we're forecasting are necessary. That $70.7 million is broken down here by department, and just some notable decreases and increases from this year to next. In accounting, we're seeing a decrease there, but that's because we have an accountant that we're going to allocate more time to the water department, which will be a bigger expense for water. And we also were budgeting NISC to come on site for some consulting this year, but because of COVID, that got pushed off. The auto shop, they're going up because of a one-time capital purchase. They need a new lift that can accommodate some of the heavy trucks and equipment that we have. So that's going to be a one-time increase in the auto shop. Broadband is going down due to less capital projects. And a big one is the finance general administration. That again, is going down solely because of the Forks Operations Center was budgeted there, and we don't have very much to finish up next year from that. The general counsel and general manager basically offset each other. With the loss of Simon, we won't have his salary in that budget this next year. But unfortunately, under Doug's budget, under the general manager, we need to accommodate higher increases in legal fees. So those two are basically offsetting. The materials department has a pretty big jump. Across from the administration building here at the old Costco building, it needs a new roof, and so we've budgeted for that next year, and it's also going to get a lighting retrofit to LED for conservation purposes next year. Ops is going up primarily due to capital and personnel-related expenses, but good news on power supply, we're actually going down next year, and that's because BPA has put the financial reserve surcharge on hold for next year. And we're also have a renewable energy credit contract that's expiring where we're paying $14 a rec, and the new contract will be at $5 a rec. So that's substantially cheaper than what we've been paying for renewable energy credits. Finally, on transmission, their increase there is solely based on capital projects for this next year and some carryover from this year. And actually, I can turn it over to Ruth here right now, and she can go over the capital piece for the electric division. So, Ruth, if you're ready, I can transition to the next slide here.
Great. Thanks, Sean. Hi, everyone. As Sean said, I'll be going over both the capital and debt for all three divisions. I should note that the figures for each capital project do not include internal labor costs. So, thanks, Sean. Starting with electric, we've categorized the capital into three groups: transmission, distribution, and other. So, starting with transmission, a number of these projects are carryover from this year. They include the Highway 101 South Idaho Forks project, the Forks rebuild, the airport substation to the BPA substation transmission rebuild, the airport rebuild and transformer disposal, and the demo of the SQUIM substation. The bigger projects for transmission are the Forks rebuild at $350,000. That involves replacing all the 40-year-old equipment out at the Fork substation. Next, we have the airport substation to BPA substation transmission rebuild for $1 million plus. That includes replacing all the transmission poles and lines between the airport substation and our point of service at BPA's PA substation. We also have the new BPA relays at $238,000. This is the district's final payment to BPA per our contract for new relays to be able to serve Laird's Corner and airport substations. Lastly, we have the PA switchyard and circuit switchers at $310,000. So using the district's existing vacant property, we'll be installing two new circuit switchers and three switches, and that allows us to safely serve the west direction transmission line serving airport and Laird's Corner substations. Thanks, Sean.
Yeah, just one quick question.
Sure.
The SQUIM substation demolition, any concern about PCBs there?
I'm going to defer to John on that.
Yes, we'll, we have no known leaks at that site while the substation was in operation. So
that's over the history of the substation, you don't.
That is correct. Now, for the old Carlsberg station, we did know we had a regulator fire and some oil spillage. That was adequately cleaned up when we transferred the easement back to the customer owner, and we did test there. Generally, we will not test unless the property was going to be transferred, but by all evidence, we do not believe we've ever had an issue with that. The demolition will just be removing the old superstructure and everything that we aren't going to be using in the future for a potential microgrid project.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, John. Okay, for distribution, the carryover projects are the Black Diamond Road project, the SQUIM microgrid project, the Evans Road feeder tie upgrade, and the Johnson Creek feeder C to Johnson Creek feeder B tie. The bigger distribution projects are the Black Diamond project, budgeted at $120,000. This is a distribution relocation project due to Clallam County's road widening project. We also have the SQUIM microgrid at $115,000. This is an R&D project consisting of adding a battery bank to the existing community solar generation system. Okay, lastly, we have other electric capital, which includes our regularly budgeted items with the exception of the following. First, we have the CQ kiosk for $40,000. The kiosk itself is actually sitting at the central warehouse facility, and we're just waiting for Hope Construction to proceed with their work. Next, we have the remainder of the Forks Ops building for $500,000. Next, we have the CWF new roof and LED conversion for $405,000, and we'll be hiring a consultant to determine if skylight should be replaced and or if the roof should be restored. We also need to relamp the existing fluorescent lighting system, and since we'll have to hire a contractor and lift for the relamping, we're taking the opportunity to upgrade to LED. Next, we have the emergency response plan supplies for $60,000, and this should be the last year that we need to purchase those supplies. And lastly, we have the CETA decarbonization fund transfer for $575,000 that Sean spoke to earlier. All right, we'll move on to debt. So you'll see here the table at the top is Electric's debt service due in 2021, and it's broken down by principal and interest for each bond issue. The graph below that is a representation of all of Electric's debt payments through term for its $33.7 million of debt outstanding. And you can also see on the graph how each of those bond issues is paid down. So the teal colored bars, that would be our 2016 bonds, and we'll be done paying those in 2028. And then so on, looking at the light blue, that's our 2010 BABS bonds, and those will be done in 2030.
So with interest rates kind of down to historic lows, are we looking at refinancing some of these bond issues?
Go ahead, Sean.
I was just going to say yes. We have looked at it. I've talked to our our underwriter over at Piper Jaffray as well as Nancy Neres. And unfortunately, we don't have any of our bonds that are callable yet without paying penalties.
Yeah.
So to answer your question, yes, we've looked into it. Can we at this point? No.
So these bond issues, some of them are tax exempt bonds, right?
They're actually all considered tax exempt.
They're all considered, okay.
Yeah.
So, yeah, okay. Thank you.
Okay, so just as a recap, I thought I'd go over what each of the bond issues is for. Starting with the 2010 Build America bonds, the district issued $11.2 million at 5.25% interest. And these bonds are unique in that they have biannual subsidies that offset our cost of borrowing by 35%. So it effectively brings our 5.25% interest rate down to 3.4. And the district issued these bonds for typical electric capital, including reconstructing and relocating transmission and distribution lines, constructing and rebuilding substations, re-insulating lines, and installing SCADA. The 2014 revenue bonds, the district issued 14.2 million bonds at a 5% blended interest rate, and those were issued for the construction of three buildings, including the admin building, an engineering addition to the op center in Carlsberg, and a meter substation shop. The 2016 revenue refunding bonds, these bonds were issued to refund our 2008 bonds. We had $8 million outstanding, and that essentially saved the district approximately $700,000 in interest costs. The original 2008 bonds were issued for typical electric capital as well as land acquisition. The 2018 revenue bonds, the district issued $9 million in bonds at varying rates from 2 to 5%. And that was for the site work and construction of the Forks Ops Center, improvements associated with the equipment building, and substation rebuild projects.
Ruth or whoever, in the out years, do you, we don't show any assumptions about possible bonds that we would ask or we would get in the future. Is this really what our projection is that we're not going to need anything except what's on this chart?
That chart just shows what we currently have. That doesn't show any of our needs.
Okay.
Hey, Jim, I'd like to add, we're trying to plan the 10-year budget, at least 10 years looking ahead, with no new borrowing, although there's a slight potential on the distribution battery of borrowing a small portion, probably not through bonds, but through a loan. So we're making every effort. We completed this, after this year or next year, we will have completed all the major substation rebuild projects, as well as all the facility projects, and we do not expect to borrow money over the next 10 years. Not absolutely certain, but that's our plan.
So what I'm hearing is we do not anticipate having to incur more debt to satisfy CETA. That's going to come out of reserves and out of rates.
That is correct. So basically one of the things we're doing with the transfer to the CETA account is to try to plan for CETA in a way that does not incur additional borrowing, at least not to do so over the next 10 years.
So if we get out further and we want to take a position in a SMR or something, then that would be additional borrowing.
If the CETA fund did not fully fund an SMR, yes. Since an SMR for us would be on the order of $30 million, it would take a long time at $575,000 per year to reach that amount.
Yeah.
And, of course, I might add that, you know, depending on regulations, and it seems we get new regulations all the time, I guess going to 100% clean should last us quite some time. But initially, when we started looking at the facilities and the substations, that was the goal, is to get all of our facilities and substations upgraded during this time period. You know, we added the admin building and the substation down at, or not the substation, the substation shop and the operations addition for the engineering group, and then our new building, the main office. So, and then out now out at Fork. So every single one of our major facilities are completed and should be good for another 40 to 50 years. So that's a major capital projects that we had. Many other utilities now are just starting into their new buildings or adding new building new buildings. So we believe we're ahead of the curve and still have comparable rates to the other utilities. So we're kind of proud of what has been done. Same with substations upgraded. A number of substations have been combined. So we've replaced, I don't know how many total is that, John, that we combined to reduce the number of substations, but we had about 27 to start with or so, and now we're down to about 22 or 3. Is that right?
After next year, I believe we'll be down to 20. We'll have replaced or consolidated 6 substations.
Yeah.
I believe last I heard, the CETA rules were out in draft form. And have they been finalized yet? Do we know what the final version is?
I have not seen a final version.
No. We've been heavily involved in reviewing them and making comments, working with WAPUTA, and trying to get it favorable towards the PUDs and the customers.
Yeah, Nicholas Garcia over at WAPUTA has been intimately involved in the process, and I haven't seen anything from him that indicates that they're getting close on the rules.
Yeah, I know there's a lot of concern about those draft rules that came out.
Yeah.
So, okay.
Okay. Thanks, Ruth, for going over that.
Yep.
The next piece here is just a couple slides on personnel. Not a whole lot to go over here. We do have a few changes that we plan to make next year. We have a tree trimmer helper that's going to transition to an apprentice slash journeyman. We have a forks operations assistant that's going to get promoted to journeyman. And then the biggest change is probably in the engineering department. John Purvis and Mike Hill are currently working on a reorganization for the department that's primarily driven around workforce development. And I believe that its primary function is to foster internal talent to make sure that we can continue our engineering functions without having to go to the outside workforce and develop internal.
Have we hired a new engineering manager or not?
Mike Hill is the engineering
manager. Oh, yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah. Sorry, I forgot about that.
Yeah, Will, I'll add that the primary focus here is they've had almost a complete turnover in engineering
over the last. That was my next question. How much turnover are we getting?
an awful lot. And we have vacancies, long-term vacancies, and we're looking at taking the approach of taking the hit and trying to develop our designers in-house and not rely on outside hires to fill these vacancies. So it's going to place us in challenges, but we're looking at the end goal of getting qualified people able to do designs effectively and sustain that going long term.
Okay, good.
Thanks, John. On the position additions, we do have two, but they're transitory in nature. The first one is the compliance analyst that we just brought to you for approval prior to this presentation. That's the part-time position. And the second is adding an auto shop helper next year to the auto shop. And that's primarily planning for two retirements that are coming up with our mechanics. Some other highlights, we're going to continue to proactively search for our line department. As you all know, the retirements in the line crew severely impact the utility. The meter reader reductions in staffing are going to be delayed about a year. When COVID hit, we had some delays with procurement of meters for our AMI project, which in turn has slowed down the rollout of our AMI. And because of that, we're probably going to be a year behind in staffing reductions there. We're also postponing a facility helper position. And with the additions above and the planned retirements, it's going to be no permanent long-term FTE additions to the utility. We're also planning on adding a staff 457 match to our employees at 2%. And assuming that all eligible employees participated, that would be about an $84,000 expense next year. And then finally, on the CBA wage increase, that's already been set and negotiated for May 1st of next year, and that's going to be a 3% increase to the bargaining unit wages.
I believe that the matching thing, that there's a lot of utilities already doing that, so I assume we're trying to attract people.
You know, I was trying to find some numbers on that, Will, and I believe that we are one of only two in the state that don't have that program right now.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
The final piece on the personnel, I just wanted to add this in here to showcase the fact that since 2015 to this last pay period, we're down three full-time employees. And on the surface, that might not sound all that impressive, but when you factor in the fact that we've discontinued some very expensive contracts, for example, the landscaping was a six-figure contract, and we brought that function in-house. Same thing with our courier service. We've brought that function in-house and gotten rid of a more expensive contract. And we're also meeting new state requirements with regards to flagging in-house and also not going outside. So we've become a lot more lean and more efficient utility. And the reason I picked 2015, because I distinctly remember Doug challenging each of the departments to develop and find more efficient ways to conduct business. And at the same time, we were exploring the opportunity to go out with a more robust enterprise software system. And Doug embraced the conversion with NISC, which is a fully integrated enterprise software system at the utility that went live in 2016 and also in 17. And it's made a dramatic impact on the utility. And like I said, we're accomplishing more with less staff, and we're more efficient as a result of the changes that we've made. So just thought it was important to highlight that, you know, we're down personnel and we're more efficient as a result.
So CETA requires a lot of reporting, a lot of bookkeeping. So you think we can maintain this trajectory on and accomplish all that?
I believe that we can, but without the final draft rules, it's difficult to say what is going to be expected of us, Will.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm hopeful and optimistic that we can with the staff that we have.
I think, Sean, you pointed out, too, on this chart, on staff, if you look in 5 years on staff, it went from 53 down to 43, a total of 10 on the staff side, whereas we went up 7 on the union side. However, the staff or a number of the positions have picked up and combined the responsibilities, so it seems to be working quite well, too.
Yeah, and I'll add that over the 10-year budget, we project either 5 to 6 new staff reductions over that time.
Okay. Before we move on to the next section, how about we take a short break?
Sure.
Okay, thank you. Okay, is everybody back? We'll
yep.
Drive on.
I am back. Will, you ready for me to continue?
Yes, please.
Okay. Jim, are you back?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
I have a barking dog, so I'm on mute.
I'm sorry, what was that?
I said I have a barking dog in the background, so I was on mute.
Oh, okay. Okay, so finally on the electric piece, I just have a few slides on the overall summary. Okay, so this shows our revenues coming in at $68.9 million for the 21 budget against $70.7 million in expenses, which leaves a net change in reserves of almost negative $1.8 million. And we'll have ending reserves, less restricted funds of $18.2 million, which is about 121 days cash on hand. And normally when you see that big of a dip in our reserves, I would become alarmed, but when you look at our 10-year forecast here on this next slide, you can see that, yes, we are going to start dipping in our days cash on hand through 24, getting down to as low as 116 days, but we do start to increase all the way up to 150 days in 29. And the benefit here, as John pointed out, is it includes no additional forecasted borrowing. And we're also funding the CETA decarbonization fund for the battery project, all with a downward rate trajectory. From 21, we're forecasting 3.5% rate increase all the way down to 2028 and beyond, where we're forecasting a 3% with no borrowing. As John mentioned, in the year after we do the battery project, the forecasted rate would be, if it was in 2028, for example, instead of a 3% rate increase, we would forecast 2.1% increase in that year due to the demand and shaping changes that would correspond with our new BPA bill. So what does that look like for 21 impact to customers? Well, for the average residential customer consuming 1,250 kilowatt hours per month, their bill would go to $134.68, which would be a difference of $4.59 per month for those customers.
Hey, Sean.
Yeah.
I know I could open up my econ book and figure this out, but what does that rate impact look like by 2030?
You mean if I forecast it off of the rates over here?
Yes.
I can do that for you, Jim, and send it to you. I don't have it off the top of my head, unfortunately.
Yeah, I think it'd be, since we're showing, you know, a 9-year or 10-year forecast here, and then your next slide gives it for what's the financial impact for this coming year. I think we also should show what it looks like over 10 years, because if you're a business, you know, trying to make an investment decision to move to Port Angeles or something like that, I think, or if you're a resident looking here, I think it's, you know, kind of helpful to understand, you know, what your.
Yeah, no, I agree. That's a good suggestion. I can definitely incorporate that into, would it be okay if I included that into the final presentation in December?
Sure, yeah.
Okay. All right. Any other questions on this slide? If not, that will bring us into the water and wastewater systems for the district. Okay, so a few assumptions on the water and wastewater side. As you all recall, you've approved a 2020 through 24 rate increase that is part of a 5-year plan to achieve a uniform postage stamp rate structure amongst all the district's water systems. One thing to note, we may have to update our cost of service late next year or in 2022. Some of these WSDOT projects have gotten fairly expensive, and in many cases we're unaware of them until the last minute, and so it could put some pressure on the water system going forward. And on the wastewater assumption, we the systems that the district has are very small, and so we just base our assumptions off of the same customer count for next year as what we have this year. And again, the wastewater rate increases was also part of the five-year plan that was approved with the water system. So on the revenue and expenses for each system here, so first we'll jump into water. Next year we're forecasting sales to be about $4.6 million. As you recall, last year we did a rate redesign where we have conservation rates for water. And then we also have a rate increase forecasted, so that's what the increase in sales is due to. But the other big change is just primarily from loan proceeds. We're projecting more loan funds this year than next year. So the 2020 projected versus the 2021 budget total revenue is very close year over year. On the expense side, excuse me, on the purchase resources, one thing to point out here is that we were in negotiations with the city of Port Angeles in 2019, and it got settled into 2020. So we spent a lot more money on purchase resources this year, and that was to back pay some of the bills from 2019. But moving forward in 21 and beyond, that should be closer to $300,000 per year and more consistent than what it shows in this graph. And then the other big change is that we're doubling our capital expenditures from this year to next year, primarily from carryover pieces and also a more robust capital plan next year. On 21 wastewater, the biggest change here is that we do have a project that we need to do on Sunshine Acres 1 for a new lift station. And that's where the capital funds transfers comes in. That's the biggest change from last year, is we're making a capital funds transfer of $88,000. So total revenue for wastewater is $159,000. And on the expense side, anytime that we have a capital project in sewer, we have more water salaries and wages that get transferred to sewer for that project. And so we'll have $159,000 in expenses next year as well. So from here, I'll turn it back over to Ruth to go over the capital for each of the different systems.
Thanks, Sean. Okay, so here we have a summary of the 2021 water capital. Some of the bigger projects are the WASDOT projects, totaling $228,000. These projects are all related to the Fish Passage court case. And as Sean mentioned earlier, basically they'll be replacing culverts with bridges to allow for better fish passage. And we need to move our pipes out of the way and then back during that construction, or for that construction. Next, we have the Carlsberg projects, the new transmission line, and the new water source. Those total $560,000. And those are projects we're actually partnering with the county on. And a big challenge with those are reserving water rights issues. Next, we have the Clallam Bay CQ safety infrastructure upgrades for $574,000. This project is actually funded by a Public Works board loan. And lastly, we have the Mount Angeles projects for $672,000, and that involves moving a pump station and doing an engineering study to see how much it would cost to put in a new reservoir.
What's that Morris Creek purchase dam diversion facilities? Is that the Port Angeles little turbine they've got up there and the associated facilities?
That is a project that we're partnering with the city on. And Tom, are you available to answer anything about that?
Yes, I am.
Oh, fantastic.
Oh, okay.
Hello, commissioners. The dam still is owned by the city, but we have maintenance responsibilities now. So I think as part of the negotiations for renewing our wholesale water agreement and service area agreements, we're going to have to adjust, you know, the transfer of ownership of a dam to the PUD. So right now, I have no idea what the actual asking price is for purchasing it. We're the only ones who are in, we're interested in purchasing that dam from the city. And that is a water diversion for the Fairview Water System.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Sean. So for sewer, the big project is the lower lift station for Sunshine One, and that's just basically a carryover project that they were unable to complete this year. So moving on to debt.
Quick question on that.
Sure.
That was concerned about nitrates in the Colesburg area. Is that going to require something that we have to do for our water system or not?
I'm going to have to defer to Tom on that one again.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, no problem. Yeah, nitrate in Carlsberg, we've been looking at the long-term trend. And for the previous, you know, 5 years, they've been increasing regularly every year. And but in the last year or two, they flattened out a little bit. So that's a good sign. But we are looking at putting in a new well, Carlsberg, working with the county, like Ruth mentioned. And new well could possibly be, you know, a brand new source for Carlsberg if the nitrates decide to start increasing again.
Tom, one of the reasons that the whole sewer was installed was because of the nitrates too. So the more people that hook up to the sewer, theoretically, I guess the nitrates should be flattening out or reducing. Isn't that right?
That's right. Yeah, that's the sewer is providing source control.
Right.
For the nitrates.
Yeah, they were blaming it on septic tanks, I believe.
Right.
There's lots of them out there that still have are active and have not hooked up yet. So.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Tom. Okay, so looking at water's debt, the table at the top shows water's debt due in 2021 broken out by principal and interest for each loan. And then the bottom graph shows all the debt payments through term for all of water's outstanding debt of $6.5 million. And again, you can see, you know, based on the colored bars, when things drop off once they're paid. As a recap, the five drinking water loans are all for various Fairview Water District improvements. The 2005 drinking water loan, water borrowed $3.4 million at 1% interest, and that was for the replacement of the water plant. The 2010 drinking water loan was for the Bluffs replacement wells, and that was a $2 million loan with 50% forgiveness. The remaining $1 million is repaid at a 1% interest rate. The 2011 drinking water loan is also for the Bluffs replacement wells. This was a $2.6 million loan with 30% forgiveness. The remaining 70% of $1.8 million is repaid at 1.5%. The 2012 drinking water loan is also for the Bluffs replacement wells and additionally for the Old Olympic Highway pipeline upgrade. That is a $3 million loan at 1% interest. The 2016 drinking water loan is for $650,000 and we've drawn approximately $500,000 to date and that's at 1.5% interest. And that was for the Deer Park Road pumping project. Then we have the GIS electric loan to water. That was $121,000. And that was for the GIS SCADA software. Basically, it allows for online monitoring of water system levels and functionality. The 2019 first federal loan, that was $570,000 at 3%, and that was to replace a reservoir cover in Gale's addition. And lastly, we have the Public Works Board loan. That's water's newest loan, and that's $607,000 at 0.63%. Tom expects to make the first draw by year end, and that loan is for the infrastructure safety upgrades for Clallam Bay and CQ. Then we have sewer. Sewer only has one loan, and it financed its upper lift station in Sunshine by borrowing $68,000 of the First Fed loan monies from water at the same rate of 3%. And then you can see in that lower graph what those payments look like through term.
All right. Thanks, Ruth. Just a few more slides to get through here real quick on the water and wastewater. So last part here is the summary, and this is for water. So we have a 21 budget revenues of $5.3 million against expenses of $6.9, almost $7 million, which has a net change in reserves of negative $1.6 million, leaving water forecast for the end of next year at $1.4 million, which is about 137 days cash on hand. As I said earlier, because of the fish passage and the reduction in reserves next year, Tom, Ruth, and I will definitely watch the operating account and make sure that we don't need to do a COSA earlier than we had originally planned. But 137 days is still good, and we'll just keep an eye on it next year. For the wastewater, we're forecasting $159K in revenues against $159K in expenses, so basically no change in reserves next year for sewer, ending at $55,476. And finally, I just wanted to include this last slide to illustrate where we're at on our five-year plan. We're in the 2021 bar graph there for this presentation. And as you can see in the blue bar graph, the water districts that are in Carlsbad, Clallam Bay, Evergreen, Fairview, Gales, Mount Angeles, and Monroe will pay $72.65 per month next year for 700 cubic feet of consumed water. And then the bar next to it is Panoramic Heights and Island View. And as we progress each year through 2024, we'll complete the plan and get to uniform rates and rate parity amongst all the districts. So next year it'll be a $2.89 impact to the blue graph, $3.57 for Panoramic Heights, and then $5.07 for the Island View District. So with that actually is the last slide, and so we're open to any questions, concerns, comments that you guys have at this time.
The schedule for the workshop, and we have to have this approved by, I've forgotten the date, I think it's whenever.
Yeah, we typically bring it to the board in December for final approval.
Okay. It'll probably be the second or the first board meeting in December is what we'll be shooting for.
Okay, thank you.
Hey, Sean, I appreciate the little piece, the ad or statement you put in the PDN about that we were reviewing the budget and strategic plan. It might be helpful to do that again because I can't remember if you said it's going to be finalized in December, but if you didn't, maybe to put another one in there, or even so, in another few weeks, remind people that it's out there.
Is that something that T puts in the paper, or is that Nicole, Doug?
Well, Nicole or T does,
okay.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
We can do that, Jim. We can add that in there.
Okay.
Thank you, Commissioners. I appreciate your time and the opportunity to present it to you. And if there's nothing else, Ruth and I will take a back seat.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Ruth and Sean. Thanks, Sean. It was a good presentation. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I'll add a comment.
Oh.
I have some happy news. I just had a cancer checkup last week, and everything's still great. So.
Oh, fantastic. Good.
What is that? Congratulations. 12 years now, Ruth?
No, it's been 15.
Oh, 15 years.
Wow.
It feels like a lifetime ago, but.
That's great.
Every year, I'm glad to hear the good news.
Absolutely. So are we.
Yes.
Okay, our next item is correspondence and communications. We've got a drawing for the Waputa Educational Scholarship. And I think Nicole's going to do that. Whoever.
So Nicole's going to bring it into. Oh, okay, T's going to bring it into Will, and he's going to pick the winner. Or at least the winner that goes forward to Waputa.
I get all the blame for this, right? Gee, thanks.
Natalie Loshi. Natalie, L-A-U-S-C-H.
Everybody hear that?
No.
No, I didn't hear it. Let's try it again. Natalie Loshi or L-A-U-S-C-H-E.
Oh, that's Rebecca's daughter out in Forks.
Ah, okay. Well, good.
Yeah.
Congratulations. But, you know, there's a problem. Well, it's not a problem. It's an opportunity. She has to write a essay, which will be submitted to Waputa's staff, and then they'll select the winner from that. So she better do her homework. And the essay has to be relevant to some energy issue. So anyway. All right, is that all we had on correspondence communication, Doug?
Yes, that's all.
Okay, great. All right, Commissioner reports. Dave, you want to go first?
Yeah, I'll go ahead and go here. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. I had a few meetings in the last 4 weeks. With the North Olympic Development Council and also with the North Olympic Legislative Alliance that primarily focused on broadband, and their consultant is working on putting together surveys and things so we can get an idea of where the greatest needs are in the county. One thing that was pointed out at the meeting is that in some cases we don't necessarily just want general information. For instance, in some areas you have certain times of day where you have pretty good internet, other times you don't. So trying to focus in on a level of detail to just get a better feel for where the need is the greatest. Articles came out in PC Magazine mentioning that Starlink has got a pilot project going with the Ho tribe that is at the extreme end of our service area and has always had very challenging connectivity problems. And so far the reports are that the Starlink is working real well. That's the low orbit satellite internet that Elon Musk is the founder of, and so we're going to watch and see how that progresses. Also, the North Olympic Legislative Alliance has hired a lobbyist to lobby for meeting the needs of people in the peninsula, and I think one of the meetings we had, we identified that we needed to make sure the lobbyist doesn't just look at land-based, like fiber solutions for improving broadband, but also other methods, which could include the low orbit satellites and things like that. The other thing is looking at subsidies available to low income people. Apparently the direction the legislation the state is going is to limit subsidies to minority groups and criteria that is probably more appropriate to the urban areas. For instance, I think I read recently that Federal Way is one of the most needy places for improved broadband in the state, because they've got a lot of people there that are underserved. And, of course, the criteria there for providing subsidies is going to be a lot different than it is in the rural counties. So let's see. Other than that, went to the Waputa Water Workshop at the end of the September, and a couple things that were of great interest. In many of the sessions addressed the upcoming regulations, which I'm not going to get any details on, but one thing that was pointed out is that 20 years ago, the regulations for surface water in Washington got much more stringent, so a lot of purveyors went to more underground systems and avoided surface systems. I think in the case of the PUD here, we've tried to utilize all the sources that we've had available, and that's probably been beneficial, is the limitations in drilling wells and things like that have increased over the years. Another thing that was discussed quite widely was emergency preparation, just with respect to the emergencies utilities normally come up with, but also earthquake preparation and things like this, and pointing out that rather than having a plan that we put on a shelf, it's very critical that we keep ongoing planning efforts going so that people are staying engaged and staying up with what the current needs are. So I think from what I've seen at the PUD, we're doing a pretty good job on that, and, of course, can always improve upon that. So that's all I have for today.
Okay. Jim?
Let me ask Dave, back on the broadband issue you talked about. I guess I heard some feedback from your meetings and discussions. Did we infer that we have a policy that we don't want to, what's our position on actively pursuing innovation with, end of the line delivery, retail delivery, when it's not provided by CenturyLink or somebody else because they just don't want to do it? If we got a policy on that, or is there a statement we've made, or?
As far as I know, we are focused on the middle mile, the fiber backbone aspects of it, and then also the final mile, but not becoming a retail purveyor, since that would involve a big expansion of services that we would have to staff up for, and that would probably be very difficult to implement. So I think just providing infrastructure for other retail providers to come in and provide that service.
Yeah, so this is Steve. That's correct, Jim. Yeah. Our policy for the last 4 or 5 years has been basically to provide the middle mile and then let the ISPs do the last mile.
Yeah, and Steve, I don't think there's really been an official policy, but that's been our position. It's kind of a neutral. We support the ISPs, and we'll use to get to our substations and our facilities was the number one priority. Up till this last year with COVID, there hasn't been any real push or priority from the community. It's only been really since COVID that they've really started pushing quite hard, and rightfully so. And so we are getting involved. Steve's involved, and so is Sean Delplane, with looking at grants and working with the different communities and talking with NOAANet and talking with the county associations too. The amount of money required is substantial, and that's something we'll be looking at.
Okay, thanks, Doug. That's more in line with what I thought we were putting out there, is that given COVID and everything and technology, that we would keep an open mind about that final mile, and look for money opportunities, grant and otherwise, that could help fulfill that need and kind of help our folks that are underserved.
That's correct.
Okay, thanks. Oh, so since the last meeting, I haven't had any formal meetings other than I did participate in the the auditor's in briefing separately because we had two commissioners there. And so I listened to everything he had to say and so forth. And, you know, we just asked a couple of questions about process in terms of our ability to ask questions in terms of how we compare with other utilities and so forth like that. And so that's all I've got to report this time around, I think.
Thank you, Jim. I'm glad you reminded me about the auditor. I'd forgotten about that one. Yeah, I attended that meeting and represented the utility there. This is the entrance conference with the auditors. As usual, they were very complimentary of our support of their audit function and so on. So anyway, we'll see how that goes. I believe December is the exit conference, so let's hope we get a this is not financial. This is, has to do with a lot of the new conservation programs and so on. In the future, it'll be all about CETA and 937, so we've got both of those to deal with. There's annually the Energy Northwest Executive Board sends representatives for what's called a due diligence conference. This is with the with major financial institutions. In the past, we've talked to three or four, like Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan and Morgan Stanley, a number of them. And this time, we actually had a virtual conference with J.P. Morgan, with the rating agencies, and with the bond counsel, and a firm which advises on debt. This is important because it's part of the regional cooperation debt program, which Energy Northwest, in collaboration with Bonneville, started this in 2014. And the advantage of it is that Energy Northwest can issue debt at much lower rates than Bonneville. Bonneville pays 7% interest on treasury loans. And we've got actually some of our bond issues have been under 3. So that's a substantial impact to the region, substantial impact to Bonneville's rate setting. And to give you an example, basically the phase one, the first phase of the regional cooperation debt has saved the region $2.7 billion through reduced Bonneville rates. We have recently, in fact, it was last year, the Executive Board of Energy Northwest approved a second phase of the regional cooperation debt, which would go over a 10-year period and would involve something like $3.5 billion. So some serious money. So it was kind of interesting, the overall discussion of Bonneville's debt and you know, basically Energy Northwest, it's kind of a circular thing because Energy Northwest's debt is backed up by Bonneville. It's actually Bonneville's debt. So they look at the credit rating of Bonneville. And of the three rating agencies, we had Moody there, Finch, and S&P. They all gave Bonneville fairly good ratings. It was interesting that one rating agency looked at the reserves issue with Bonneville and said that, well, because they were having to impose this reserves surcharge on their rates, then that was a negative, so they dropped them down one notch. Then another rating agency looked at that and said, well, Bonneville was able to address the shortfall in reserves by imposing the surcharge, so they brought them up one notch. So they're not very consistent in what they do. But anyway, it was interesting. interesting session. As you know, I asked the question since they were talking about going forward and what the interest rates were going to be, the market for bonds and so on. And I asked the question that the COVID thing, the potential for a impact in the finance markets, the ability for developing a market for our bonds, was there going to be an impact from COVID and what the Fed does and what the markets do and so on? Surprisingly, they said no, and I kind of had to shake my head at that. I hope they're right, but we'll see. Then they went on to talk about the market for Energy Northwest bonds. It appears that the next step in going forward would be to market bonds internationally. And this would be Europe, China, and so on. And some of the issues that the Europeans especially have is that Energy Northwest is zero carbon. So that makes them very attractive in the European market. The Chinese, who knows what their motives are, but hopefully they've got a lot of money and they can invest in that. It all came down to branding and green attributes. And Energy Northwest, since it has nuclear, which is zero carbon, operates dams, has solar farms, and so on. So it's overall considered to have a lot of green attributes. Let's see, what else should we talk about?
Hey, Will, you muted.
Did you hear any of my presentation at all?
Yeah, it was just the last few minutes or last 30 seconds.
Great.
Or so.
I didn't touch it. Oh, well. Well, anyway, I went over the international markets that seems to our bond issuers think has a lot of potential in Europe, especially because of the green attributes of Energy Northwest. I don't know how much of that you heard, but operate dams, solar facilities, and the nuclear plant, which is zero carbon. So the market should be very good in Europe. Then the other piece of that is they're going to China into the future, and we'll see how that goes. The IRS has rules as far as our tax exemption status. We've issued both tax exempt bonds and others which are not tax exempt. The those rules will impact the existing debt that we go out to, but for new borrowings, the rules don't address that. So we'll see how we go with that. There seems to be a lot of benefit or a lot of market for tax-exempt bonds for obvious reasons. Anyway, we'll see how this plays out. The part of that agreement with Bonneville is that they will come to the executive board annually, and we will approve this regional conservation cooperation debt annually, and they will put a presentation up to assure the executive board that any savings will flow to rate reduction so that Bonneville customers and our customers will get the benefit of that those programs. And so far that's worked very well. They come in with presentations, where they're going to spend the money, how it's going to impact their rates, and so on. So overall it's been a real winner, so we'll see how things go in the future. But $3.5 billion all in the queue to to do further benefit. And I guess that's all I had. So, staff reports. We have a report on the 2021 strategic plan. I believe, Doug, that's you.
Yeah, this is kind of a repeat. I guess it's probably worth repeating. We had the 2021 strategic plan in the package that was sent out, and Nicole put it on the website. And any comments that customers and commissioners have, we've got 2.5 months or 2 months here to make comments and see what comes back from us. Same thing goes again with the budget. We'll have that open for comments. Both we're looking at getting approved in December, the first meeting in December. So we'll as Jim mentioned, we'll put it out and we'll do it periodically for the next couple of weeks and make sure people are aware that it's an open time to make comments. For all your information, if you remember the last presentation that was given with Sean and John, there was four options at the end, and at the end of that, there was the strategic plan. They showed a couple of areas, I think resources was one of them, that we changed, and those changes are in the new 2021 description, talked about technical, looking into the technical areas for future resources. So that's where it is now, Will, and commissioners, and we'll be listening to what the customers have to say and be able to evaluate that and let you know what they were and what was added or what was changed on the strategic plan.
Hey, thanks, Doug. And I really encourage the public participation, the folks on the call today. I appreciate you being on the phone and listening to this. I'd ask you to really look at the strategic plan and give us your insights. If you have questions, call me or any commissioner, and we'd be glad to talk about it. And, Doug, maybe when you put it out, like in the little newspaper clip like you did for the budget thing, that you mentioned – you know, I don't know about the other commissioners, but I would encourage the public to call their commissioner and provide input if they, you know, can't make it to a public meeting or something, or just want to ask questions about it. I think, you know, that'd be a good thing to do. I'm certainly open to that.
Yeah, I'm sure they are. Now, when we submit that to the paper, then the paper takes what they want and puts it in the paper. We can certainly, you know, let them know that we'd like the public to be informed and request that they make input, and if we have the paper on the meeting right now, we'll let them know that that'll be a request to go out to the public to comment on the strategic plan.
You know, I think that that's a good program, good way to approach this. The only problem I can see is that the comments are going to be from a minority of our customers. So we may have to do a number of iterations. Any proposed changes may have to go back so that we can get more broader input than just a few people.
Yeah, well, staff will be evaluating it, and of course, we'll be bringing forth any changes that come forth. We won't implement every change that's made or commented on.
Not.
Yeah,
that's right.
But we'll certainly take it into consideration, just like we do when the public opening and closing the meetings. The public makes comments, and some of them are very good comments, and we'll be happy to do that.
Okay. All right. Our next item is.
I just saw a comment from someone here about social media too. We can Nicole can certainly put that on the social media that we have, and I think that's a good idea. And I would believe that. Well, I know Nicole can do that and will do that.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Thanks for the comment there, Paula. Good idea.
Okay. The next is a CARES update from Sean.
Yeah, so we got our amendment to our subrecipient agreement on Saturday from the county, and that will allow us to offer the funding through November 30th instead of October 31st. So that's some good news. That will go before the county commissioners next Monday and Tuesday for approval, And so once it's approved, we'll have through November to disperse the remaining funds. So just an update on the funds. We got $45,200 in mid-August. And to date, we've dispersed $28,756 and have $16,404 remaining. And the average grant size is $233. And so we have to connect with an additional 70 customers based off that average, which would be about 10 customers per week. So I'm hopeful that we can get through the money. I know that customer service, specifically Shanda, has been working extremely hard on reaching out to all of our customers, sending robocalls, door hangers, letters in the mail. We're doing everything that we can to get the word out. And Nicole's also been putting it on social media. It's on our bills. So it's been a full court press, and hopefully we can get through the money by the end of November.
So wasn't the primary reason that people weren't applying that the bar was set pretty high to prove that you were impacted by COVID? Has that changed or not?
Well, the bar
we didn't set that bar. That was set by the county, I guess.
Actually, it was set, yes, that was set in our subrecipient agreement with the county. However, we've since asked for clarification from Commerce on acceptable proof of hardship. And operating under what Commerce has told us, we can now accept self-attestations as a last resort. If they can't prove it any other way. And so since we've gotten that clarification from Commerce, we've definitely seen an uptick on the amount of awards that we've granted. So,
yeah.
And I know, Jim, you had called me last week and said that you were going to reach out to the tribes out west. And I don't know if you had any success with that, but we do still have quite a bit of funding available if you have a contact that we don't have access to.
I did call the McCaw events, Vince Cook out there yesterday, like or Friday, and so let him know and, you know, encouraged him, gave him the link to the website. And I'll go ahead and do that to the Quileute and I guess we have some Ho customers too and the Elwha. And if you want, Will, I'll just go ahead and include Ron Allen in that with the
Okay. Yeah. Sounds good.
Yeah. Nicole has also coordinated with the HR department, at Jamestown for all the furloughs that they've had. And so I know that our information got disseminated to all the people that have been affected by that. So we've been doing a good job getting the word out. Unfortunately, we still have quite a bit of money left.
I think, as we mentioned in the past, that one of the big hindrances of this whole thing is the governor proclamation of not allowing us to disconnect.
Right.
We believe if we were allowed to disconnect, we'd have more, we could get rid of that money and even get more money if it was available to customers. But I think so many customers think that even though we emphasize to them that it's not a forgiveness, that they believe that at some point in time, there's going to be federal or government money coming in, state money coming in. And so they really just haven't been, you know, beating the door down. Once you disconnect somebody, then they come beating the door down. So as nice as it is not to disconnect, it could hurt in the long run. And we've made that comment through WAPUTA. WAPUTA's been emphasizing that to the governor's office too.
Yeah, if these people would take advantage of those programs and pay their bills, then that would be to everybody's benefit. So, okay. Is that all we had on that?
Yes, sir.
Okay, next we've got Mr. Steve with a broadband grant update.
Okay, this will only take a minute. I just wanted to give you a quick update on where we're at on the grant that we applied for. About 2 weeks ago, they emailed us for some clarification about three or four things they needed. We submitted that on time. On the 23rd and 11 days from now is when they're going to determine who's going to receive grant money, so we should know, you know, within 2 weeks on the 23rd. And I will come back to the board in the next meeting after that to let you know where we stand, whether we got the grant or not. So
Steve, where does the bond issue, from knowing that and participation by all the members, where's, you got an update on that?
I can give you an update on that. We have a KnowNet board meeting this Wednesday, day after tomorrow, which it'll be brought up. I have a feeling that, well, I know that all the members are going to go in agreement for the bond, so we are going to have to follow suit. So I will give you an update on that, too, for the next board meeting. But at this point, it looks like everybody's in agreement to go out for the, I think it's $23 million, 13 to pay off existing loans and another 10, which they will use as a draw of $900,000 a year for 10 years for capital improvements.
And we're on the hook for 10% of that, right?
Yeah, we're up for 10% of that. Exactly. Well, we're on the hook for 10% of that if they default.
Yeah, I know. That's what
you
mean. Yeah,
that's what you mean. Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you. Board action items. Do we have any? Or
The action items that are recorded are that Nicole is to post on social media the draft strategic plan. Excuse me. And also that Sean is going to add to the final presentation of the budget in sometime in December, additional information that Mr. Waddell requested.
Okay, thank you.
And, T, in addition to the strategic, so budget too, that the budget will be out there too to review.
Got it.
Thank you.
She's got it. All right. Comments from the public. Do we have any additional comments, Sean?
Nothing through chat, but if anybody would like to make a comment, go ahead and let me know your first name, and I'll put you down. Hearing none, Will.
Okay, good. We do not have an executive session. Is that right, Doug?
That's correct.
Okay, good. All right. If that's no other business to come before the board, we stand adjourned. Thank you to everyone.
Thank you, everybody.
Thanks.
Thank you.